Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
This is the Analyzing Anfield podcast on the Blood Red Channel, bringing you the best tactical and statistical analysis of Liverpool FC.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Analyzing Anfield, your tactics and analytics podcast, courtesy of the Blood Red Channel. I'm Josh Williams and I'm joined by Mo Stewart. Mo, how'd you feel, mate, on the back of a Liverpool win?
I know, it's almost unbelievable when you think about where we've been, but I mean, in the true nature of this show, I remember a couple of weeks ago we were complaining where it's like every week there's one game that's good and one game that's bad. And that's pretty much been the case since we last did a show. There was one game that was really bad and one game that was better. But yeah, it was nice to see. It was nice to see as well that some of the things that you and I have been calling for happened and they worked. So that's good as well. But yeah, generally a little bit more positive.
Yeah, well, it was Liverpool's first win of 2023, which is saying something, really. So we're going to touch on talking points around that game. And we're also going to look ahead to Chelsea, because I think out of all of the Premier League at the minute, they are one of the most interesting clubs, to say the least. Chances are they'll probably make a bid for one of me or Mo Jordan this podcast.
Trust me, I'm not shifting.
No, I think I'd reject the move to myself as well. But yeah, we'll start with talking about Wolves. Now, I think this is an interesting one, this, because I don't want to start the show on a dampener, but I don't think Liverpool actually played that well, if I'm honest, and I'll touch on why. But I think the narrative that Liverpool did play well stems from A, the results, and B, the fact that the basics, on a defensive sense at least, were finally back, and that's certainly something to build from.
No, I agree. I think, to be honest, there's a certain amount of leeway I give, in as much as I suspect that the instructions were very much more focused on the defensive than the attacking. But as I'm sure you're probably going to point out, I had a sneaky peek at the XG for this game. And yeah, Liverpool didn't exactly hit the heights, I think it's fair to say. But they got the job done. And I think it's interesting to talk about where you build from there. That's a harder question when you consider the personnel and the team we're playing next. But just from a point of view of wanting to see positivity, wanting to see energy, effort, enterprise from a Liverpool side, and solidity, I think seeing those things almost made you remember, okay, so they can do it. It is still in there. And I think that's probably why the overriding feeling was more positive than specifically looking at the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm honest, when I was watching the game, I did like the performance. You know, it felt good watching Liverpool, and people were you know, tweeting and things like that, saying like Liverpool are back and stuff. And I can understand why, but at the same time, if someone who hadn't watched the game, if they'd just checked the numbers, it would have looked like Liverpool had again been kind of like outperformed, basically, in a lot of departments. So just to provide a bit of context on what I mean by that, Liverpool posted 7 shots, Wolves posted 11. Of Liverpool's 7, 3 of them were in the penalty box. And none of those 3 were particularly central.
No.
Liverpool posted 42% of the ball, fewer passes, and the goal that won the game was the furthest shot of the game from about 30-odd yards. You know, obviously an absolute screamer. But ask Harvey Elliott to do that again. Maybe he'll struggle. So I think it's weird in that sense, because again, it felt like a decent performance. It felt like we applied ourselves. But the expected goals in particular, 1.5 for Wolves and 0.2 for Liverpool. So most weeks we do not get a goal in that game. No. But again, just touching on the defensive positives, I can obviously understand why people liked what they saw, and you know, the press was back in particular. That was a nice thing to see.
I think you're right, and the only thing that was missing was the press creating good chances, which, if you think about it, it's kind of what it's originally there for. But it was working, and I think that's, again, something really important to hold on to. In terms of the performance, I think what you saw was attackers who were given very specific and strict and strong defensive instructions. I think if you look at Cody Gakpo in the center, he didn't drift very far from Ruben Neves. Ruben Neves is kind of like their, because Moutinho was playing a little bit more advanced than normal, Neves was their guy who was going to be hitting the switches to Traore. He was going to be trying to dictate the play. So Gakpo was basically trying to stop him having time and space on the ball. Harvey Elliott and Carvalho, farther from doing a more of an attacking job and trying to tuck in narrow and get in and around Gakpo, they were again blocking lanes out to the wide players. So they were a lot wider than they had been previously. But because of where they were within the structure, it created a more compact structure. It was like a 4-1-4-1. And sometimes it was even a 4-5-1. And they moved more connectedly. They moved together up and down the pitch. And I think there was so much focus on that that it was almost like nothing else was going on. I take your point about Wolves' shots and their higher XG, but I think if you look, most of that came in the end of the game. So
I should have pointed that out, to be honest.
Yeah, they didn't have, I think that there was one which is classed as a big chance, which considering how many we've been giving up, one is great. And it was like in the 85th minute, I think, or something. And to be fair, Cunha had Joe Gomez in his face. So I'm not even sure how big that big chance was. But we did a better job of stopping them doing what they wanted to do. And apart from us being able to do what we needed to do, it wasn't quite there. But when you think about the goal itself and the timing of it, when it came early. And that allowed us to relax a little bit. And I think we saw some of the other improvements, like we were much better on the ball. We were able to keep the ball, string passes together, move from one end of the pitch to the other through our passing, which if you think about the performance at Brighton and Brentford and some of the others, that was missing as well. We couldn't really string two or three passes together. So we had that confidence of, okay, we've started well. We've not conceded first. We've actually scored first. We can settle into this game. It's a little bit of a bigger pitch at Molineux as well. So you've got a little bit more margin of error for passes because it's harder to cover if you're an opposing side. So all of these things were helping us kind of get into it. We didn't get the second goal. And then it was almost like a decision to, okay, we're going to kind of keep what we have and be more and keep the solidity and try and keep them out, which admittedly we did.
Yeah, I do think confidence plays quite a big part on Liverpool at the minute. Obviously, we're not in particularly good form. But it feels like lately, I've seen at least two games, and this is now three, where the first goal in particular has really impacted Liverpool's mood and Liverpool's behaviour on the pitch. I think back to the game in the last game of 2022 against Leicester. And off the top of my head, I remember us vaguely starting reasonably well, but then falling off a cliff when we conceded. Yes. And I think in the 2-2 draw with Wolves, in the FA Cup. Again, I think we were doing okay. We looked like ourselves, and then we concede, and Everton goes off a cliff again. Mm-hmm. And I think it just kind of shows, like, when you're in a poor run of form, how fickle your confidence can be, really. And I think we saw after Elliott's goal, Liverpool started to play with real confidence, particularly in the middle. It felt like we had a midfield for once.
Yeah.
I thought Thiago was great. I thought Pesetic was great, who we're going to get to. Naby Keita was great. You know, and it felt like Liverpool kind of, and I don't have too much of an issue with this, it felt like Liverpool almost sacrificed their attack to get back to basics with defence. And maybe if you take that same approach into a game when you've got Mo Salah, Darwin Nunez and Cody Gakpo as your front three rather than Elliott and Carvalho, who are two kids, maybe you can sacrifice the attack and still pose a threat on the break and things like that, and pose a threat in certain moments because you've got the players to do it. But I do think it's needed. I think it's overdue because Liverpool have been leaning way too much towards the attacking side of the game all season, really, and it's caused too many issues.
It has, and I mean, it's kind of understandable when you think about that's where the big new pieces have been and where the big changes have been with Mane out and Nunes and now Gakpo coming in. You understand a little bit that the game plan would be more centered to attacking to try and find ways to make them work. But the irony is that in reality, when you think about quality attacking players, to a certain extent, if you've got a solid defensive base and you give them the time and space to say, go on and win the game, you see that a lot of times, don't you? Where a team will have maybe three players, attacking players, and everyone else is in defensive sets. And whenever they break, it's up to those three players to go and win the game. I mean, Spurs have been doing it ever since they've had Kane and Son, to be honest. So you do see that happening. There was an interesting comment that someone made on one of our on another show, talking about the difference between a sprint from Harvey Elliott and Carvalho and maybe a sprint from Henderson or Thiago. And it's like, they're really sprinting. They've really got that energy there.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, Nunes and Salah have the energy to do that, but they are going to be thinking more about the other things. So it might become a little bit more difficult with them in there, but then that's the balance, isn't it? And I think we've been battling that balance all season long. We've tried to be more expansive and evolve as a team, then it hasn't worked and we've had to go back to compactness. And then it feels like we've kind of repeated that all again in the second half of the season, whereby after we went to our mid-season break, they tried again to be a bit more expansive. It hasn't worked and we've had to kind of potentially go back to being compact.
Analyzing Anfield on the Blood Red Channel.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, this is worth touching on, actually, because obviously the talking point throughout the season and what we've primarily highlighted as the main Liverpool issue has been the midfield and the fact that the midfield won't put a challenge in and things like that. And although I stand by that, I think you also have to couple that in with the fact that the forward line, really, in comparison to the past like 7 years, is really different when you think about it in a defensive sense. Like, Darwin Nunes is intense. You can tell he's intense. There's nothing wrong with that. He's nowhere near as good defensively as Roberto Firmino is. Not even close yet, at least. And then on top of that, Sadio Mane was a defensive monster as well. Like, more than willing to put a foot in.
Oh, yeah.
Often played on the very, very edge. Tracked his man back up and down the flanks all day. And the players who've been playing in place of Mane have been Carvalho. Luis Diaz has been injured for a while and hasn't been at the club particularly long. And now Cody Gakpo, who didn't post pressing numbers really in Holland. Could be a PSV style thing, you know, nothing to worry about particularly. But in addition to Liverpool's midfield being like old and a bit tired and things like that, you have a front line that just hasn't been anywhere near as protective almost of what's behind them, and in the midfield haven't protected what's behind them.
Yeah.
And then shock, all of our centre backs have had calamitous moments this season. It's because they're wide open. It's like a ripple effect, really, isn't it?
Completely a ripple effect. I remember my dad talking about how the centre forward was always the first line of defence. I mean, I think talk to older Liverpool fans to tell you Ian Rush was the master of that, of being that first point in the spear when it comes to actually defending. And you take that out, and like you say, it's not just about the energy and the bit, it's more about the technique and the nous to do it. And Gakpo, Nunes, they are still young players, they are still learning the trade, and they're at the stage where most of their learning has been concentrated on doing what they're there for, which is putting the ball in the net. Now you're coming to a team with a bit more complex system, like a different system, and you're having to pick up these things. So, yeah, it is very much the fact that that has influenced this, has influenced that. But that also means that there's more things that need to be fixed. And I think that one will be fixed with time. It's interesting. There's going to be a conversation around the personnel changes, and I'm sure we're going to touch on that more when we talk about Bajcetic and Keita. But I think the structural change was as big. I think the whole the 4-1-4-1 web almost as it was, and the way that they were moving together, that was what allowed us to go and start the pressing higher up the pitch, because we were doing it as one. We were moving up as one. We were moving back as one. Bajcetic did a really good job of staying centrally. And it allows you to be more adventurous in those things. But is that something that we saw from those players? Or can we put other players into that system and see it retain?
Well, I've seen a lot of people say on the back of the performance that should be the midfield to face Chelsea. And I actually don't have that much of a problem with that, to be honest. I'd definitely keep Thiago in there, obviously. I'd definitely keep Naby Keita in there. And in terms of Bajcetic, I thought he was brilliant. But it is Chelsea, so potentially Fabinho comes back in. But I thought Bajcetic didn't put a foot wrong for me. But you touched there on like the system just kind of working a little bit better. I also think it stemmed from Gomez and Konate. I thought they were really aggressive compared to usual. I thought they were really forward and really in the face of the Wolves forwards whenever they received the ball. And overall, Liverpool as a system, as a unit, were just a lot really proactive from the off. The front line actually sprinted when it comes to pressing, actually closed down their men and pressurised them into mistakes. The midfielders just won challenges, which is just hasn't been happening. And the back line was aggressive. And I just think it really does feel like the basics, just do the basics. And I think Pep Linders made the comments, I think it was about 2 years ago now, he said something along the lines of like, first we have to do what's necessary, and then we can do what's pleasant. And yes, I think Liverpool have kind of got to a point where they've got that a bit confused a little bit. And hopefully this is an indication of going back to what's needed in the defensive sense and going from there, really. Go on.
Totally. And I think, because I was going to mention the goal, Harvey Elliott's goal, because I think it's a really good indication of not only that, having to do the hard yards to earn the right to do the fun stuff, but I think it's the reason why it was such a growth in confidence, because it looks on the face of it as if Harvey Elliott's taken the ball from his own half, run half length of the pitch and smacked it in the top corner. That's a wonderful individual solo goal. It wasn't a solo goal. It was a goal that took, I counted 9 of the 11 players, Liverpool players on the pitch, had an active role in it. And it started at the other end of the pitch with Liverpool on the attack. It started at that end of the pitch. Liverpool on the attack. Milner plays a ball in. It's cut out. Wolves intercept and break. They play 2 quick passes, and you've got Aitnori in down the left-hand side, up against Milner, and then you've got Gomez out there on the cover. Everybody else is out of the game. Now, Gomez manages to block the shot, but if you think about what we'd have seen previously, that rebound, the second ball, would have come to a Wolves player. This time, you've got Thiago, and you've got Tsimikas, and you've got Bajcetic all there to clean up before any of the Wolves players come. So we're getting back in position when we've been beaten better. So that's a big tick. Then you've got to play the balls under pressure when the Wolves guys arrive. So Thiago plays it back to Keller. Keller plays it to Tsimikas. Tsimikas plays it up line to Carvalho. All very simple, obvious balls. But something that we've been messing up recently that have been causing goals. So we did it calmly under pressure. Carvalho's got the ball on the right side, facing his own goal. Previously, we've seen him maybe get out-muscled, lose the ball, and then we're going on the counter-attack. He doesn't. He's under pressure. He goes back towards Tsimikas, plays another simple ball. Allows Tsimikas to, if he wants to, clear it upfield, release the pressure. But Tsimikas doesn't do that. He plays the ball back inside to Thiago. And it basically, the 1 10-yard ball cuts out half the Wolves team and starts this chance. Because Thiago then turns around, sees that he can play Elliott in, and suddenly we've got 3-on-3 running at their defenders. That becomes 4 because Milner busts his gut to make another run in the opposite direction 20 seconds after he did his last sprint to give an option outside, which means that the left back, Johnny Otto, he can't come in and tackle because he's got to think about him on the right side. You've got Gakpo and Keita running into the box, stretching the play, taking the centre-backs away, but also fooling Jose Sarr into thinking the through ball's coming, which is exactly why he's so far off his line, because he's ready to come out and smother the ball once the through ball comes. I don't know whether or not Elliot or even Milner, who's shouting at him to shoot, noticed this, but you suddenly got a situation where Elliot's 25 yards from goal with a keeper who's miles off his line with a load of space and potential options occupying all the defenders. So then he's going to have a go. And like you say, you don't. It's a 0. Something on the XG. It's not a very high XG shot. It's 30 yards from goal, but it's been created meticulously by the whole team. 35 seconds from the time Milner loses the ball there to going back to scoring the goal. And everyone's connected. It's everybody's doing their job the way they're supposed to do it. And the reward is a goal. And that's why I think so many of them took confidence from it. Because it wasn't just about Elliot. Everybody played their part.
Yeah, I do particularly like Keita's run. I think Keita's run from deep to stretch the back line and take them away from Elliot as he's carrying the ball towards goal was important. You mentioned Carvalho there. I do feel like in a lot of games this season, he has looked like he's just been bullied and out-muzzled. And in this game, there wasn't one instance where I thought he's got to be stronger. You know, he stood up for himself, basically, which sounds a bit stupid considering he's like, he's not 12, is he? But he looked after himself a bit better, I think.
Overall,
I think it was a strong Liverpool defensive performance, very robust, and people putting challenges in and things like that. But one person I do want to touch on is Stefan Bezetic. I've been asked by one of our listeners, actually, regular listener, to kind of analyse him, right? As though we are signing him.
Yeah.
So analyse him like he's a new signing. That is tricky. And the reason that's tricky is because he's just barely played. So in terms of the numbers, at least, we have no clue what he looks like. You know, he's got 38 minutes in the Premier League so far in total, and all of his other minutes have came in like the Carabao Cup, which we don't really get data for because it's just the Carabao Cup, the FA Cup, which is the same, and I'm not sure if he's played in the Champions League yet, but if he has, it's probably as a substitute or something. So in terms of like the numbers and what he's going to be as a player in that sense, and what he's doing as like an outlier maybe in comparison to his peers, we don't know yet. But in terms of watching him, he is interesting, isn't he? He's just turned 18,
yep.
89 days ago. What do you think of him? Or what do you think we can, in terms of like a template, like a blueprint for him, a player who he could follow in the footsteps of, what he could become when he's like 23 or something? What picture are you painting in your head?
I think he can do the job that he was doing last against Wolves very well, as in he can be a number six who stays central, is able to give structure to the team, is able to break up the play, has good close control, can find his teammates and keep the ball under pressure, can be press resistant but also good at pressing. And the reasons why I think all of that is that from speaking with Matt Addison when we've been doing the academy shows and just speaking to other people who are watching him in the academy regularly, one thing that always comes through, or two things always come through: bravery and intelligence. Bravery to know when you can step out with the ball, know when you can maybe dive forward and take a tackle and leave your position, but also intelligence to know when you can't. And that's something that a lot of young players struggle with, that discipline, that intelligence of knowing when you can and judging when you can't. And you need that if you're going to be a number six, because you have to be anticipating where the ball goes if what happens doesn't happen as it should do. You have to be there ready to close the passing lane, to block or to mark a player across the other side of the pitch. And he shows that he's got that. And not just from what I saw in the game against Wolves. I've seen that from him previously, and I've heard other people talk about it. I think physicality is always going to be the question about him, because he is 6 feet tall, but he's not big. So playing in central midfield, you will see people try to test him in that. If he was to play, for example, against Chelsea, you can bet that Kovacic will try to get in and around him, try to rough him up a little bit. But I think he's got the temperament to do with that. The biggest thing for me at the moment that he needs to kind of be able to nail that down is he needs to improve his passing range. That was probably the one thing that did let him down a little bit against Wolves. There were a couple of stray passes. But again, the system and the determination of the team on that night helped him out. So he needs to develop in that area, but a lot of the signs are good. Genuinely, a lot of the signs are good. I still think we will need to sign someone to play that position. But if he continues to develop as he has been, I think that he will be a very good alternate option.
Analyzing Anfield on the Blood Red Channel.
Yeah, I'm not sure in that sense, actually. I'm becoming, well, on the back of the Wolves performance especially, I'm a bit more convinced now that we could potentially get away with not signing the six. Say, for example, we get Bellingham and Nunes on the off chance. Two number eights, really. Bellingham can play as a double six, but they're two number eights. And I think that would then leave the six open to be occupied by Fabinho, Henderson and Bissetic at times. And obviously, by the time Henderson is leaving, potentially maybe Bissetic is ready to become more of a starter. But I think to sign a six who's a really good age, you could block the pathway there for Bissetic. And I think that's a bit of a problem, considering he does look good. He does look like he could potentially be Liverpool level. It's not like he's a kid who you can quite clearly tell he's going to be sold for a profit. He looks like someone who could genuinely make it.
Oh yeah, definitely. But
if you look at his game anyway, like what he's good at and things like that. Obviously, as you say, he's really press resistant, calm when he's under pressure, good in tight spaces. I think he's a good passer of the ball, but as you say, in terms of his range, his passes are kind of like subtle and over like 10 yards, aren't they? Rather than being like, Hollywood passes in the mold of like Steven Gerrard or something like that. I don't think he's too much of a vertical runner in terms of both boxes. I think he's more a player who will remain in the middle third for the whole game.
He did.
And that's not a bad thing, considering Liverpool don't really have many just those sitters who just kind of like hold the fort and just remain deep and let all the other players go and attack. I think he suits that. As you say, he's over 6 foot, so that bodes well for him in terms of playing as a six. And in terms of like stylistically, who I thought, I was trying to think to myself, who does he remind me of? Because he reminds me of someone. But I couldn't really nail it. But he reminds me of like a bit of a cross between the two players, right? And before I say this, I'm going to throw in a massive caveat. I am not saying he's going to be this good, right? I'm going to put that out there immediately. This is not me saying he's this level. But stylistically, he looks like a bit of a cross between Pedri and Busquets to me. Typically Spanish, very Barcelona, in the sense that he doesn't really ever seem to be in need of breaking a sweat. And his actions are really subtle and under the radar, and I don't know, idea that he'd be that good, but stylistically I think if he reaches like his top level or whatever, I think he will be roughly that sort of player, like a Busquets kind of six, who doesn't really run too much but runs the game with his head and makes really subtle passes around the corner, and you can just never really phase him through pressure, things like that, really.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think Busquets is a name that's already been mentioned by a few people in relation to him, specifically for what you said in terms of the style, the way that he's able to affect the game in a wide area without necessarily having to run here, there and everywhere. I think if you look at kind of like, there's a few stats out there of the kind of passing lanes and stuff like that of the game from last night, and you see Thiago kind of bunched on one side with Carvalho in the fullback, and then you see Keita on the other side with Elliot and Milner, and Bacetic is in the middle, very much almost dead stock in the middle, and he's connecting everybody. And again, it goes back to what I was saying before about the intelligence to be able to play that position. It's something that you don't see very often in younger players. You see them, if they're playing that position, it's almost like, well, we're doing you here because we trust you to do the simple thing and play the simple ball. But if you go back and watch Bajsetic, particularly last night, I said before that some of his passes went astray. What he was doing more and much more than Fabinho is he was looking forward with every pass. If his first option when he had the ball was, can I progress it forwards? And if he can't, then he will turn, he will look, he'll protect, and he'll maybe lay it off. But the amount of times that we advanced just from him, a little turn around the corner here, or a drop of the shoulder and a layout wide to an advancing fullback, and just having that mentality of always going forward. I think when we've seen Liverpool have poor tempo with their passing and look like they're just too slow and boring, a lot of that is from the sidewaysness, and to the point where Liverpool have almost started kind of bypassing Fabinho a bit in their passing build-up for that reason. So having him in there really added that extra impetus. And if you've got someone who can play those progressive balls from the centre, then you dictate and differentiate what the opponents are going to do. And again, that's going to open up more space.
Yeah, well, this is why it'll be insistent for when we eventually are able to look at his numbers, basically, because we can't really apply that too much just yet. But it would be interesting to see, to quantify his ability to pass forwards, his progressive passes and things like that. It'd be interesting to put a number on how often he keeps the ball, essentially, you know, his ability to retain the ball. Because one thing we know, for example, Thiago's really good at is merging ball retention with ball progression. A lot of players usually fall short in one of those departments. But he looks like a top talent to me. He's as I say, he's 18 years old. He's got lots of things on his side to be really good. And he looks like a really standard, stereotype six, really, who's not almost more of a little bit more of a throwback, maybe, in terms of, like, not so much of an athletic runner, even though he's got that about him to an extent, but just more of a player who just typical number six, just really intelligent and like a Guardiola six, who just kind of like runs the game and subtle passes around the corner and never under pressure, never phased, sees the game before everybody else, that sort of stuff. Obviously, I'm giving him a lot of compliments. He's still a teenager.
he is, and I think as good as he's been and as promising as he is, I think the fact that we're talking about how little he's played shows where he is and where the management really think he is. I do still think, as positive as all that was, I still think it's a big step for him to start against Chelsea, considering not just the fact that it's a big game, but the nature of the big game, in as much as it's one that if we lose, then top four becomes a very, very, very difficult thing. And so the kind of heightened pressure on that kind of game makes me think that Fabinho will come in, but I do think he's played well enough to earn himself some time on the pitch, and that might be in itself the key to victory, because it means that we can make changes before players get too tired to play, but one at the right time, so we can maintain that level of intensity. I might be wrong and he might be thrown in there, but I still think personally that it's better for him to be able to come on and affect the game rather than be given the burden of responsibility of having to do that. Although, and I say this with kind of without knowing what Potter's going to do, Carney Chukwuemeka played in their last game, started their last game. He's 19. Conor Gallagher started their last game. He's 22. So he might not necessarily be up against Jorginho and Kovacic. And so you never know.
Yeah, I mean, one more decision Klopp's got on his hands for Chelsea, that you know, the midfield departments, is Keita versus Jordan Henderson when it comes to the midfield role on the right, usually. What are your thoughts on that moment, James, of like who should play?
I've been calling for Naby Keita to be more involved for quite some time. And I think we saw why over the last few performances. Last night was the first of the performances that didn't allow the people who don't like him to go, but did you see when he did, blah, 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 blah. There was none of that last night. Everything that he did was what he was supposed to do. And he was the real difference, I think, in terms of winning the ball back high up the pitch and the press returning, because a lot of the time it was him in those advanced positions who was leading. And I'm looking at his stats on FPref, and yeah, they always look good. That's part of the conundrum around Keita. But I want to focus in on a couple of things that he is in the 99th percentile of, like literally the best in the world. One of them is passes blocked, which is basically blocking passing lanes. It's not necessarily making tackles. It's getting in the passing lanes, disturbing the opponent's build-up play and allowing you to be in position to then strike. He's better than like 99th percentile. It's like there is maybe one or two people better in the world than him than that. And that's such a key to what we saw and what we need. The other one is goal creating actions from dribbling. Now, if you think about, again, where the areas of the pitch that we want to see him in and the ability to do the defensive things, but maybe also do some of the attacking Harvey Elliott style things in terms of moving forward with the ball, creating goals, not just creating shots, creating goals through dribbling. Now, a lot of those is where he dribbles, has a shot, gets saved, and then there's a goal. Or is he do a dribble and then he'll lay someone through, a ball will go across to the area, and it's a tap-in. But it's a goal. And again, there's very few people in the world better at him than that. When you align that to the fact that he does have the intensity, he does have the tackling, the pressing ability, and the structure, for me, I think he has to play.
I think he's a kind of like a solid blend, really, between what Harvey Elliott gives you and what Jordan Henderson used to give you, at least. I don't want to be too harsh on him, but I don't think he's had a great season, Henderson.
No.
I think he's been a problem at times when he put on the pitch. And I think Keita the other night, just a solid performance. Like, nothing particularly... Not much stardust, really. Just kind of like the basics of a midfielder in terms of like passing forwards when you can, contributing an attack when you can, offering elements of control to the game, and winning challenges. And I thought he put himself about. I thought he made his presence known. And it was enough for me comfortably to keep Henderson out of the team. I suppose the only issue surrounding that would potentially be like a fitness thing. You know, Henderson's now had a week off preparing for Chelsea or whatever. And Keita has played midweek, and we know that Keita maybe isn't the most robust member of the squad. But considering he's been rested for months, he should be good enough to play twice in a week, really. But, you know, other than that, I can't see a reason to start Henderson over him, if I'm honest, apart from the whole leadership stuff.
Well, yeah. And I mean, again, leadership is interesting because, yes, people will turn to the facts of the Wolves game. Well, obviously, Milner was playing, and so he was doing a lot of that. But again, you watch that game, you saw Milner shouting and pointing. You saw Bajcetic shouting and pointing. You saw Joe Gomez shouting and pointing. They were all doing it. They were all engaged. So I think it's a bit of a spurious thing to say that's the only, like, we have to have him in for that because we can't do it without him. No, we can do it without him. The fitness thing is interesting, though, because Naby played 90 minutes. And not only did Naby play 90 minutes, he left it all out there. Like, if you watch at the final whistle, like, people focus on Harvey Elliott, like, absolutely spark out on the floor. Naby was the same. He basically keeled over as soon as the ref blew the whistle. And he was so... He put it all, his all into that game. I think that he has enough in him to go and do it again. But if you're Klopp and you're unsure and maybe you feel like you have to have Henderson in there, that's the excuse you're using. If he does it, it's a mistake. I think it's that simple, but I can't at this stage rule him out from doing it. In fact, his press conference is happening in a few hours, and I might get a few more clues from where he's leaning off the back of that. But I agree with what you said in terms of the halfway house between what we want from Elliott and what we want from Henderson. He is it. And thinking about it, when I was listening to you describe him there, kind of sounds like someone else, a kind of a rather short in stature Dutch fella that people have said that we haven't replaced. Maybe he's right there. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good point. But I think the whole leadership thing around Henderson, I think it's always been, you know, one of his strengths, if you like. But I think the issue is when that's your only reason to play him, you shouldn't be playing him, really. You know, we can't be in the team for that and that alone. Bottom line is, he's a player, and he's not a coach, you know. So, and the past two appearances he's made, he played 68 minutes against Brighton. We got absolutely hammered, and he played 67 minutes in the 2-2 draw against Wolves, and we got completely overrun in that game as well. Now, I'm not saying he's solely responsible for those performances, you know, because it was a collective mess, really. But I don't think he's done enough this season, to be honest, to stay in the team beyond Naby Keita, who's just been solid away at Wolves. So it's interesting, this whole leadership thing, because, like, you know, a lot of the time it's almost overemphasized, and, you know, leaders have to be in the team and you need the leader and all things like this. When in reality, usually when you replace those leaders with just more capable players, nobody looks back. Nobody even, you know, no one thinks about it. But I don't know. I get the impression Klopp's really reluctant to lose Henderson and Milner for those kind of old school reasons.
I was listening to one of our fellow rap guys, Dan Morgan, talk about this and about the personalities and the makeup of the squad, and how, if you think about it, a lot of them are just nice, calm, relaxed fellas. They're not necessarily barkers, aggressive, in-your-face kind of players. And if you think about the nature of the football that we play, it is aggressive. It is in-your-face at its best, that high press, high attack. So you're kind of asking people to come out of their comfort zone. So maybe the reason why he's so keen to keep them there is because he knows that stuff comes natural to them. And I think in the team, you look at Robbo, for sure. I would say probably Luis Diaz as well, and maybe potentially Nunes. Those are the guys who you say are that kind of aggressive nature naturally. And maybe Klopp just really feels like he needs more of it in his team. Again, I agree with you. That's not enough of a reason to pick somebody. But I can almost see where his lines of thought come along from.
Analyzing Anfield on the Blood Red Channel.
I mean, maybe that'll be one of the perks of potentially getting Jude Bellingham in, because I would say that. I mean, I try to avoid saying his name, but
oh yeah, that's a fine.
It's like every time I have a sad moment in any walk of life now, I just start thinking to myself, Bellingham soon, though, innit? Bellingham soon. Bellingham next couple of months. I need to move past it, because you could easily end up at the Bernabeu. But he's supposed to be this kind of intense leader, so maybe that'll remove some of the burden from Henderson, maybe, and let Klopp kind of, like, move away from that sort of thing. But before we round up anyway, we can talk about Chelsea.
Yeah.
I must be honest, Mo, I don't think I've ever seen anything like it. I've seen excessive spending and things like that, but I've never seen an approach, from the outside at least, that looks as scattergun as this. And it's not just players either, really, because there's tons of staff turnover as well.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the only other time I can think of something like this, so seismic, or so apparently seismic, where it's just like, every other day, there's a new player. What? There's a new player. What? There's a new player. How much? was Chelsea the first time round.
Yeah.
And that was, or similarly, everyone was just like, what's going on? How can they do all this? And I think the difference between then and now, though, is that then it was clearly an advantage because no one else could do that. And because the quality of play they were getting was helping them rise. And because, admittedly, not immediately, they had a coach who knew what he wanted and knew how to get the best out of them. Now, you could say that maybe they've got a coach who knows what he wants. Does he know how to get the best out of what he's got is another question. But it's, aside from the how can they afford to do it question, I just think from a squad perspective, it's just, if you've got a new manager in and you're backing him to put together a long-term plan, giving him, come the end of the season, he's going to have something like 40 players to pick through. And it's like, okay, we need to work out who's going to, like, there was a thing online, let me call it up, where it's like, you know, they have the keep, loan, sell thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Where they tell you about, you'll go through a team squad and think, oh, who are you going to keep, who are you going to loan, who are you going to sell? Now, admittedly, there's one or two names here. There's three names here who haven't played for Chelsea in the first team yet. So you can say, well, they're obviously going out alone. But I'll read you the rest, right? Marcus Bettinelli, Thiago Silva, Reece James, Mark Cucurella, Ben Chilwell, Wesley Fofana, Badia Shile, N'Golo Kante, Mateo Kovacic, Mason Mount, Kai Havertz, Carney Chukwuemeka, Lewis Hall, Mikhailo Mudryk, Raheem Sterling, João Felix, Gabriel Solanke, Bashir Humphreys, Conor Gallagher, Amari Hutchinson, Andre Santos, Armando Broja, David Fofana, I'm nowhere near the end, Kepa, Edouard Mendy, Cesar Azpilicueta, Trevor Chalobah, Koulibaly, Jorginho, Pulisic, Loftus-Cheek, Hakim Ziyech, and Aubameyang. And I've left out Zakaria because his loan's going to end. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, no one can do what they want to do with that many players. You can say, we're going to have a first 11 for this system. We're going to have a first 11 for this system. We're going to have five substitutes rotating. That's all fine. You're still going to have about eight players who aren't in the squad, aren't involved, and are going to be pissed off. That's just unmanageable. It just is unmanageable. So I was just going to say, I look at their technique and I look at what some fans want us to do. And yeah. I think, well, we can't just pretend like that's not happening, because it's like, well, there's one way of doing it that's not necessarily working.
Well, what I think is always very insistent is that, you know, that business that Todd Bowley is doing is associated with ambition. Ambition's the word that's thrown at that. I would look at that and just kind of see a lack of strategy. You know, there's no apparent strategy there. It's just kind of, as I said, scattergun, really. It's just very all over the place. And I think what kind of sums up the madness in football and, the crazy, it's just on the back of all that ridiculous turnover in the past 6 months, they're talking about sacking the coach, and like, it's just insane. Like, how on earth are you supposed to judge anything at the minute, anything to do with whether he's underperforming or overperforming, when the guy's been in charge for like 4 days or something like that? And it's ridiculous. It's just, it's mad.
You finish it. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, I think it's funny as well, because when Bowley first came in, he referenced FSG as an example. He referenced Liverpool's behaviour and things like that in the market, and he decided to approach Michael Edwards. And, you know, I just think to myself, well, that's kind of like, I don't know, it's like saying you want Christmas dinner and then going for a McDonald's. Like, it's completely polar opposites, mate. You know.
It's like David Cameron saying his favorite band is The Jam without having any understanding of what they're talking about. It's so bizarre. It really is. And I think the whole idea of them coming out saying that we want to be like FSG, that was almost to a certain extent, you know, saying the right things at the right time. But the interesting thing for me with Chelsea at the moment is it hasn't really kicked in yet, because they have got a whole team out injured. Like, a whole team out injured.
That's true.
And sometimes you say, oh yeah, no, they've got like 11 players. They've literally got a team. Like, you could play that injured team could play as a team. Like, you got Chilwell, Fofana, Reece James at the back, Zakaria and Kante in the middle, Felix, Sterling, Broja up front, Pulisic out wide, and Mendy in goal. It's like a team. But what that means is, if you think about some of those names, Wesley Fofana, Reece James, and N'Golo Kante, just off the bat, those three, I think would be in Potter's team nearly every week if he could pick them, and he hasn't been able to pick them. And if you speak to most Chelsea fans, they'll tell you James and Kante in particular are their two most important, most influential players. So to try and judge him without them is even more ridiculous in my book.
Yeah, it situations feels very similar to Liverpool in many ways, but just albeit without the crazy spending / turnover. But in terms of the squad, similar injuries and similar need for investments in the middle of the park, especially. But I think Liverpool have a much better attack than Chelsea. And to be honest, a much better back line and goalkeeper as well. But in terms of like the midfield and stuff, there's a pressing need there. But, you know, Chelsea have got in two technical directors in the past 6 months in Christopher Vivelle from Red Bull, which is interesting, and Laurent Stewart, I think, from Monaco. And Joe Shields came in as director of recruitment and talent from Southampton. Paul Winstanley came in as director of global talent and transfers from Brighton. Graham Potter, obviously, from Brighton. So lots and lots of turnover there at Chelsea. And I think it's interesting as well that their equivalent of Ian Graham has just left the club after 16 years. Ben Smith. And obviously, Graham resigned at the end of the season. And one of the people who was part of like the consortium to buy Chelsea, Bowley's consortium, was Daniel Finkelstein, who used to write for the Times. I'm not even sure if he still does, but he was the first who started like contributing with Graham. Graham's first contributions in the footballing world was like to a stats based column in the Times wrote by Finkelstein. It's really hard to say that. So I don't know. That's just a weird little conspiracy thing thrown out there. That's one to watch potentially. But go on.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are all still keeping an eye on Michael and Ian and just to see what they're doing.
I think they're very much a duo. You know, I'm starting to think that they are very much a pair because they worked together at Spurs, albeit with Graham Ware. Decision technology. Then they joined Liverpool together, and now they've kind of left Liverpool together, and they're both going to be unoccupied at the end of the season. So it's really interesting to follow that.
They could probably just set up on their own independent consultants rather than connect to a club and make bank. I hope they don't listen to this. I hope you come back. But still, one last thing I wanted to say about Chelsea, in the nature of all that spending. Looking at the table, they're on the same points as us with a game played more. We've got a game in hand, which strangely our game in hand's against them. I'm not sure how that works. But anyway, they are worse off than us in terms of Champions League qualification. And yet they're spending all this money. So they clearly aren't bothered if they don't get into the Champions League. Because they're thinking, well, we've got all these players already. So we're not going to need to buy more. We're going to just need to sell them. But this is the problem you have with every team who's tried to just stack the deck with as many good players as they can. When you work out who you don't want anymore, it's hard to get rid of them because you pay them a shit ton of wages. Because if you think about Chelsea's tactics, we don't necessarily know the details of who's getting what in wages. But I would wager, off the back of how they dealt with the Enzo Fernandez thing, where they claimed they were going to pay the release clause, then went to speak to the player and said, we ain't going to do that. You need to start making some moves here. That tells me that all of their money is going into wages, right? And they're going to be trying to scrimp on the transfer fees. So most of these players are going to be on good, if not necessarily absolutely fantastic wages. It's going to make them hard to shift. Really hard.
This is how they're doing it, though, isn't it? The stretching contracts over like 8 years and things like that, so that they get around FFP and things like that. So I've seen Liverpool link with Mason Mount, for example, and some of that could stem from the fact that Mount isn't willing to sign a 24-year contract. You know what I mean? Some players don't want to do it, so I don't know. I just want to follow, but this weekend's game anyway, it's going to be insisting. Mo, thanks for joining us, mate.
No worries, man. No worries. Enjoyed it as ever. See you all next week, hopefully with another win. Maybe two to discuss.
Hopefully. And hopefully Liverpool pick up a win. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to the Analyzing Anfield podcast on the Blood Red Channel.